If everyone had the same opinions, ideas, and values, there would be no Democrats or Republicans, no left, no right, no center. Intolerance to differing points of views has infiltrated every aspect of American society, from grade school through college, in business, in science, in churches, synagogues, and mosques, between family and friends, and even in our own minds. Thought leaders that vie for your attention are often harassed, doxxed, censored, ignored, cowed, and canceled. I challenge you to learn from everyone, especially from people you disagree with and don't like. Come with me on a journey to interview thought leaders, help them better influence their audiences, and restore the cultural balance of ideas. This is the Amplifying Thought Leaders Podcast.
Hello, you're listening to the Amplifying Thought Leaders Podcast. My guest today is Don Inbody. He's a retired senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Texas State University. He specializes in American civil-military relations and public opinion. He teaches American government and international relations courses. So, Don, thanks for coming. How you doing?
Doing well. Nice sunny day here in central Texas today.
Yeah. Well, I'm in Texas, too. It is sunny and nice. Yeah. Well, thank goodness. So, tell me about your history as a lecturer in political science. You know, what got you into it when you first started? And, you know, how has it changed, I guess, throughout the many years that you've been involved?
Well, I was a Navy officer for 28 years. I retired in 2006 as a captain. But just prior to that, in 2000, what really got me interested in the civil military and particularly military voting was the 2000 election, particularly in Florida, when, if you recall, they were talking about the absentee ballots that were coming into Florida and the initial flurry about whether they should be counted or not. And there was a lot of assumptions made. The assumption was that all of these ballots were from military personnel overseas, probably fairly correct. But then there was also an assumption that a majority of them, that most of them were going to be cast for the Republican, George Bush, and not for the Democrat, Al Gore. And in fact, the initial reactions by both political parties confirmed within the first 24 hours, you heard Republicans saying, let's count every single absentee ballot, regardless of when it gets here, and Democrats saying, no, we can't count any of them. After that, they fixed their talk. And after that, they were saying, well, of course, we're going to count all the ballots. But that got me thinking. I said, why is it true that the military vote is always voting for the Republican? Because my 28 years of service in the Navy told me that non-whites made up or were overrepresented in the military. Whites were a majority of the military. Non-whites were overrepresented compared to the American population.
What's a typical range of the different major ethnicities in the military?
Well, blacks are well overrepresented from the general population. The general population, blacks are somewhere between 12% and 13%. And in the military, they can run as high as 20%. In the Army, it's even higher. So question was, well, if African-Americans or non-whites in general tend to vote Democrat, what is it about the military that would make them want to vote Republican once they came in? I didn't think that made any sense. Well, I put that on hold because I was still in the Navy. But my last 3 years in the Navy, I was assigned to the University of Texas in Austin, and I was the CO of the Naval ROTC program there. And while I was there, I enrolled in the PhD program in government. And so I made that my main research topic and wrote my dissertation on military voting, and then ultimately wrote my book on military voting. And the crux of that research was a poll that I took on enlisted personnel. Because what I discovered was that we had a really good idea of how military officers are politically. Work has been done really well on that. Scholars as Peter Fever at Duke and Richard Kahn at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, had done some really fascinating work, and some others had too. And we really knew that officers did, in fact, tend to be a conservative and identify as Republicans. But digging into it further, I found that essentially no one had done any research on enlisted. Well, enlisted personnel make up 85, 86% of all the military personnel. So officers are, you know, a relatively small proportion of that. And it appeared that everybody was assuming that the enlisted personnel were going to behave just exactly like officers. But my 28 years of service told me that that just wasn't right. It's a different population. They act differently. They think differently.
Yeah, but would, you know, if your officer that is in charge of your unit is, I don't know, if they're very political, would that cow you into voting that same way? Would you fear that you need to vote the same way as your commanding officer?
No, I never found that. Now, it might cow them into not saying anything, but it's not going to change their vote because, one, there's no way of knowing how you vote. In fact, your comment about, you know, would, if your seniors had a very strong political position, would that cow you to a certain extent? Yes, I believe that that would cause you not to talk about it. If you happen to be a Democrat, identify as a Democrat, and you came into the military, you might be inclined to not say anything about it one way or the other. But there was no evidence that it would cause anybody to change their vote. Now, over time, the people who felt like the service was conservative and Republican, and they didn't feel that they were that, they might self-select out of the service over time, leaving behind more and more conservative and Republican identifying people in the more senior ranks. And we have some evidence that that's true. But when we talk about the total number that's there. But at any rate, I did a survey of enlisted personnel. I did it in 2008. And it turns out that Jason Dempsey had done one on Army personnel a few years earlier than that, which I was unaware of at the time, but then became aware of. And then when we compared our data, realized that we came to much the same conclusion, is that while it is clear that the officer corps is very conservative and tends Republican as much as 8-1 Republican to Democrat, not so true with enlisted personnel. In fact, we found that enlisted personnel's identification, both party ID and ideology, tended to more or less mirror the rest of the country. It was pretty remarkably the same. So
when you say that was the core of my research. Is most of the country almost evenly split, or what did it mirror?
Pretty evenly split. A few more, there has slightly more people identify as Democrat than Republican. But as we've seen from our recent elections, tends to be, you know, in terms of election results, tends to be fairly evenly split during presidential elections.
A question about election policy. It seems like it's ignored between major elections. And then when an election comes, all of a sudden, or I guess leading up to an election, all of a sudden there's a lot of maneuvering. Why can't the two parties agree on a set of rules and just stick to them? Why is there all this slippage and you know, one party says, oh, well, we shouldn't look at this, and the other one says we should, and, you know.
Well, what specifically are you talking about? The recent flap over these votes in Florida, I mean, in Georgia, and some of those things?
How mail-in ballots are handled, how absentee ballots are handled, how all this more general stuff, you know.
Well, that's part of what I came up with in research. Now, my book was a history, was two parts. The first part of it was a history of how absentee voting came about in the United States. And I kind of, one of the key takeaways for all of this kind of stuff, remember, is that these politicians, the elected politicians, the elected officials, will decide what they want to do, by and large, based on what they think is best for them electorally. So in general, we have agreed on how to handle absentee ballots. That's been pretty well decided. Now, there's some things around the edges here. And what, of course, got into the way in this one was COVID, which it massively increased the number of people who were asking for absentee ballots. And many states just not prepared to handle the onslaught of absentee ballots administratively. Policy-wise, they were fine. In fact, what we've discovered is, you know, there's no evidence that any state had any serious issues with mishandling absentee ballots procedurally. That would have been nice to have had them counted quicker. Florida had that figured out. Other states hadn't. Texas counted pretty quickly. Florida counted very quickly. Georgia had a hard time counting. Some other states had a hard time counting, but they had an accurate count. It just took them long. So what you're seeing today, I think, is merely the politicians, the elected officials, reacting to what they think is in their best interest electorally. Now, it's actually very few individuals, the president most notably yelling, but even many of the others have settled in that everything was handled just fine. So I don't know if there's a major disagreement on how to handle these particular things. I think part of the issue was these last minute changes within the states about how long they would wait after the date of the election to accept a ballot. And that varies throughout states. Florida accepts absent ballots mailed in as much as 10 days after the election, assuming that they were actually completed and mailed on or prior to the election. Texas allows 5 days, but other states, those ballots have to be in on the date, and those are up to the states. They can make those decisions. And so the argument seems to be is that they've decided, the states have decided to alter their own rules based on the exigencies of the time of thinking that people needed more time to get ballots in and because of the fear of mail delays.
Well, I thought there was debates in some states about, you know, do you need ID to vote? And, you know, if you need an ID, it would make it inaccessible to some people. And it just seems like there's been a lot of debates about the mechanics of elections for a while.
Well, there have been. The voter ID, Texas requires voter ID, other states don't. Those are decided state by state. There's no, I think one of the things that confuses people is that there is essentially no federal level overriding guidance on how to handle elections. The Constitution is pretty clear that states are in charge of their own elections and that the federal government has very little impact into handling that. And so what you're seeing is the variation of the states, which is in and of itself is a problem, particularly with the military because of all the different states having different rules, but that's a whole separate issue. But whether somebody ought to have a voter ID, an ID in order to be able to vote has been decided or is being decided at the state level. And my own feeling is I have no problem with somebody having a voter ID. I think the real issue is how easy it is to get a valid identification. And that's what really needs to be solved is is there an easy and free way to get a valid identification to all these people? That's where the real argument is, not whether or not a voter ID is a good idea or not.
Oh, is it particularly difficult for certain groups of people to get an ID, a state ID?
Sure. Yeah. Most states, you know, a driver's license is considered to be a valid ID. Texas considers it that. But what if you don't have a driver's license? Well, then they say, well, you got to get a passport. Well, not everybody has a passport. Well, then all you got to do is drive down to the local voting office and they'll give you a free ID. But what if you live out in the country, you don't have a car, or you're invalid, or there's any number of issues? So those are some of the things around the edges that are causing the problem. And as you might expect, poor people tend to be more unable to take advantage of some of those situations. So that's really where the issue comes to. I think if they can solve the problem of getting voter IDs to everybody free, but easily, then this whole voter ID thing will go away. But that's where the real argument is.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard Australia voting is compulsory. So I guess everyone has to vote or be fined. And I guess there's actually some political prisoners, you know, people that refuse to vote and they've been fined and then, you know, put in jail. But what's your thoughts on compulsory voting? Does it work or does it just create a new problem?
Well, it creates other problems. One, you have to monitor it. Two, what they talk about in Australia is it creates the aura of the Mickey Mouse vote. In other words, okay, you're going to make me vote, so I'm just going to write in Mickey Mouse on the ballot, which, you know, that doesn't help anything. There's plenty of countries have better, higher voter turnouts than we do. But, you know, it's generally in the, you know, half of the eligible voters turn out. We had a really good turnout this last election, but it's generally not much more than 60%. But what we think we know about the people who don't vote is they fall into two or three categories. There is a group of people within that who aren't going to vote. They just don't believe in it. They don't want to vote. They're conscious not voters. They have decided they're not going to vote for whatever reason. They don't think your vote matters. They don't think a system is good. A pox on all the parties, you know, whatever their decision is, they're just not going to vote one way or the other. Another group of voters, they just aren't paying attention. They would vote, but they forget about the election or they wait too late and they just can't get it done. There's any number of reasons for that. So, and there's no particular evidence, despite what everybody talks about turnout, that increasing the turnout actually does much to change the outcome of the election. There just doesn't seem to be too much evidence to support that assumption. I mean, there's a kind of a conventional wisdom that the higher the turnout, the more the favor of the Democrat. Well, we had a terrific turnout in this last election. And yes, Biden won the presidential election, but Republicans did really well in the down ballot. So that just doesn't seem to hold too much water.
So what's your overall thought process on voting in elections then? What things do you see could be used to improve the process, or it just is what it is? And, you know,
no, I think there are some things they can do. I think early voting is a good thing. There's no particular evidence that early voting has increased turnout. Texas discovered that. Texas has early voting, as you're aware. It approximately the same number of people turn out. It's just easier to find a time to turn out. Now, there's a half a dozen states have moved over to all mail voting. Utah, Washington, Colorado. I guess Colorado has a couple of ways they can mail, but they can also do other things. But some of the states have decided to go all mail-in balloting. That seems to be working quite well for them. Utah had no trouble with it. Oregon had no trouble with it. Seems to be working fine. So there's any number of solutions that'll work. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence that in and of itself that increases turnout. So I think the main thing about turnout is whether or not the people are just motivated to participate in the politics. And it seems to me if we can get anywhere from 50% to two-thirds interested, you know, we've done probably about as good as we can get under our current two-party situation.
Why not create if there is such a thing, a secure website where people have an account, maybe it's linked to a driver's license and they vote that way.
I'm not an expert in this area, but every one of the computer experts that I have talked to who have been dealing with electronic voting is very convinced that it is so insecure that our internet security is just not in place for that. Because there's no way of going back. The people will come out and they'll say, well, hell, I can do my banking. Why can't I vote? Well, the difference is if your money goes the wrong direction in the bank, you have a record to know what happened to it, whether somebody charged on your account or whether it was stolen, and the bank can give you your money back. If you cast a ballot, you don't know if something happened to it or not, and there's no way of if a nefarious actor was in the system. So you're going to have to talk with some of the experts on computer voting, but all of the advice I get from all of the experts in that area is they do not believe that internet security, that computer security is to the point where we can trust online internet voting.
Well, what about from mail-in ballots? I mean, there's, you know, at least in this election, it seems like there's signatures required, not required. You know, the envelope's kept with the ballot, the envelope's not kept with the ballot. I mean, just a whole other set of issues, it seems like.
Well, it varies by state. Yeah. I mean, some states, as soon as the mail-in ballot comes in, they validate that the person who sent it was a legitimate voter and drop it in the box. And after that, you have no way of knowing which one of those votes came from a mail-in ballot or not. Other states keep them separate. So they all hand them differently. Even with a straight paper ballot system, fraud is possible. Fraud with mail-in ballots is perhaps a little bit more possible. But the truth is that of all of the elections we've been handling, with the billions of votes that we've been handling, you know, for the last 60 years, we just haven't seen any widespread ability to impact, to change things, to commit fraud. And in fact, we're pretty good at picking it up. We picked up fraud in this last election, and some of those people are being prosecuted right now.
I don't know. It seems like mail-in, I mean, you could have millions of ballots printed up and signed and sent in through mail, and you would never know that they were.
You couldn't do that. People think that's a possibility, but you just can't do that. And here's why. One, you have to have been registered to vote in that county and in that precinct. Each precinct, and even some in multiple ballots, the ballots don't look identical. So the ballot that I get on an election day to vote on, whether by mail or standing at the voting machine, does not look like your ballot would look, because you're in a different congressional district, you're in a different water district, you're in a different school district, you're in a different county or a county commissioner district. So the ability to just print up thousands of ballots and submit them, it just doesn't, you can't, it doesn't make sense, because then you have to tie that ballot to a registered voter who lives in the same place as that type of ballot. And the problem just gets massive with that. The part that scares me.
If a state takes the ballots in, though, and then they throw away the envelopes and they merge them, so you can't tell what's mail-in and what's not. I mean, it seems pretty easy that you could.
All of the merging is done when the mail-in ballot appears. They look at the envelope. They'll open the outer envelope, and then the inner envelope comes out. And that inner envelope will have a person's name on it and, you know, who they are. Then they will match that envelope to the voter registration list. Is that person registered to vote? Yes. Does the signature match if that state or county requires signature matching? Does it match? Yes. That process is handled by a bipartisan group of election officials who are watching all of that. Then, once that happens, then the ballot is removed from the security envelope and entered into their system, either directly scanned or moved to another pile for later scanning. That's how those are handled. The ballot, and you know, is unidentifiable as to who cast it once they separate it from its security envelope. But all of that process happens prior to that ballot being scanned in to be counted. So what you're saying is it possible? Yes, it's possible. It's exceedingly difficult to do it on any kind of scale that would matter. And you would have to get so many people involved in the process of doing that it would be very difficult to even keep it secure on that aspect, to keep it away from the officials. The few times that we have detected falsified ballots is that's been detected at that process. For example, there was somebody who submitted two ballots, and they were supposedly, you know, theirs, and they were submitting one for their father or their son or somebody like that. And they detected that it wasn't legitimate. And they threw that ballot out, and that person was they referred that person to the law enforcement, who then subsequently investigated it. And I'm not sure what happened after that case.
So as of now, for this election and going forward, do you think the process is in the right spot, or does it need more modification or updating? Or what are your thoughts?
I think what they need to do is those states that had a hard time counting the massive number of absentee ballots in a timely fashion just need to streamline their procedures. And they only need to look as far as Florida and perhaps Texas to figure that out. If you'll know, both Florida and Texas have really high mail-in and early voting and on-day voting results. And both of those states got their results out very quickly. I think that's what really needs to happen. That's what Pennsylvania was not administratively prepared to count all those ballots quickly. It took them a long time. And I think that's what confused a lot of people was, okay, the election was over at 7 p.m. and then they put out the initial results, which were easy because that was the in-person votes or the early votes that were done at a machine. And now they had to start counting absentee ballots. Well, you can't count all those absentee ballots instantaneously. So they'll count a few thousand, put those in the system, count a few thousand, put those in the system. And it looks like ballots are showing up magically after the election. Well, that's not what's happening. They're just counting them. What Florida and I know Texas has done is there's a certain amount of pre-preparation allowed to these absentee ballots. And I can't remember offhand which states is which, but some states actually allow them, once they get the absentee ballot in, to go ahead and scan it in. They just hold the number. They just hold the votes in electronically. Other states aren't even allowed to start looking at or counting those ballots. So that's the process that needs to be fixed. So like in Pennsylvania, I believe, I may be wrong about that, but I know it is true in some states, they're not even allowed to start processing the absentee ballot until ballot that closes in that state. So if you get a few million of these absentee ballots in and they're just sitting, you know, in the box, now the election's over. Now we got to start processing these things and pulling them out one at a time, look at them, make sure the signature is right, and scan it in. You can see why that takes a long time. Florida in particular has that process figured out. And I think that's all they need to do is solve that problem, which would be just a case of going and getting the Florida election law and reproducing it in their state. And most of the issues that we had with people concerned about the late ballot counts would be resolved.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Don, we're just about out of time. What's the best way for people to find out more about your work and your thoughts?
They can just look my name up on the internet, Donald S. Inbody, or my book, The Soldier Vote, is available. Okay. I don't keep a very good website. And since I don't work at, since I'm retired from the university, I don't keep that up very much anymore. But I'm on Twitter. You can find me at InbodyD on Twitter, and I do post there periodically.
Very good. Well, Don, thanks for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Hey, before you leave, subscribe to our newsletter by going to www.amplifyingthoughtleaders.com, where we highlight past and upcoming thought leaders. Learn the most influential ways from experts to grow your brand, your company, and your personal influence. Go to the website and join our newsletter. If you're already a subscriber, review us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and wherever you listen.